Coming up today, the tech behind a high school prank and the hunt for COVID's origins. You're listening to the Wired Podcast, your essential weekly guide to the future of tech, science, business, and culture. I'm your host, Amit Katwala, and joining me this week are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And Natasha Bernal.
Hello.
This was the week when it was revealed that more than $100 million worth of NFTs have been stolen since July 2021, according to research from crypto analysts Elliptic. That's an average of $300,000 per scam.
This was also the week when Apple employees have protested against the company's mandate to return to the office 3 times a week, with a petition that argues that the policy is too restrictive and ignores the successful shift to remote working during the pandemic.
And finally, it was the week when Twitter's former security boss filed a whistleblower complaint against the company. Peter Zatko, often known as Mudge, alleged that Twitter's security practices are severely lacking, including employee devices and servers not being updated, the company hiring an Indian spy, and engineers having too much access to data.
How come tech company employees are allowed to have like cool nicknames? Like if I came into the office and was like, I know my name's Amit, but I want you to call me like Maverick or something, you'd be like, we're not doing that. But like tech people always seem to have like a cool nickname, like Mudge.
Yeah. I think, well, Mudge has been around in like the hacker scene and stuff for quite a long time. So like a lot of people in that space have hacker aliases and names that they use. So we can start calling you something if you want though, Amit.
Maverick.
What would you want to be, Maverick?
let's use Maverick as like a TB, like a placeholder for now, and I'll come up with something better.
That's great.
If you've got any suggestions, please write in podcast@wired.co.uk. Let's move on to our facts. Matt Burgess, what have you got for us?
So I've got an animal fact this week, and it is about seals. So you know when you see seals like sat or laying on their sides, they often have their head off the ground and also their tail, so they're a bit of like a U-ish shape. This is actually called the banana pose by some people, I guess. But apparently they're doing this because elevating their front and or rear flippers helps them to regulate their body temperature, so essentially keeping those parts off the ground to change their temperatures and deal with the conditions that they're in.
Keeping them in the air helps the airflow and move the heat away faster. It sounds like a yoga pose, doesn't it? Is that interesting fact, Matt? Thank you. Natasha, what have you got?
So I want to first disclose that I sent Matt that fact because I saw a picture of some seals and I thought it was cute.
It does have your fingerprints on it.
Yes. Yeah. But I did not know he was going to talk about this fact. And I also have a fact about animals, and it's also a positioning animal fact, which is unusual and unfortunate. But yeah, what I learned was also something I believe I shared with Matt, which is that when whales want to have a little nap, they go under the surface at about 45 meters deep and they go vertically and they have little naps together.
Are they head up or head down?
Head up.
Head up. Oh, that's quite sweet.
It's very cute. But yeah, a lot of people didn't know that that's what they were doing, and they hadn't been photographed until like 2017 or something like that, because no one had actually seen it happen.
That's so interesting. Yeah. So two positional animal facts. If you have any positional animal facts, I don't know what they would be, please let us know. On to a story that's going to talk about animals in a sort of roundabout way, Natasha.
Yes. So Amit, you've been looking into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you remember that? And you explored how researchers have been using a variety of scientific and statistical techniques and some social media scraping to trace it definitively back to its source.
Yeah, that's right. This is a story I wrote about some research that was published a few weeks ago. I kind of framed it as a scientific detective story. So as you probably know, scientists have suspected since the early days of the pandemic that the Wanan seafood wholesale market in Wuhan, also known as the Wuhan wet market, played a significant role in the origins of COVID-19. It was where kind of live and dead animals were being traded and where some of the first cases were sort of spotted. And the overwhelming scientific consensus is that COVID originated in a similar way to related diseases like SARS, so it jumped from which jumped from bats to humans via an intermediate animal. But as the pandemic's dragged on, they've had trouble kind of definitively proving this. And in the meantime, other origin theories have flowered. You've probably heard of them, you know, centered around this Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is a biological research lab in Wuhan. And the argument is that either deliberately or accidentally, COVID-19 was unleashed from this lab because Chinese scientists were doing experiments with coronaviruses. So that's the theory, or, you know, the theory that kind of disagrees with what the scientific consensus is anyway. And figuring out exactly what did happen with COVID would be really valuable, both in terms of disproving this lab leak theory, but also in terms of providing a source of information about how to stop the next pandemic. So for the last 2 years, an international team of scientists has been trying to pinpoint the epicenter of their pandemic using a range of methods, as Natasha mentioned.
So in this story, I like to think I'm your Watson and you are my Sherlock. So we'll proceed in that manner, even though I have read your story and I know where this is going. So let's first explore the scene of the crime. So where exactly in this city of 11 million people did the virus first jump from animals to humans, and how did they find this out?
Well, it's elementary. Let's not do that. So to find out, yeah, so there's a team of researchers led by a biologist at the University of Arizona called Michael Warobe. So there was this report that came out from the World Health Organization in 2021, in the summer of 2021. And they basically did this like joint investigation with Chinese officials, like looking at some of the earliest cases of COVID. So what these researchers did with this data from the WHO was to cross-reference the different maps and tables within the report to get coordinates for 155 of the earliest COVID cases in Wuhan. So these were people that were hospitalized from the disease in December 2019, right in the early days of the pandemic. What they found when they looked at this mapping of cases is that most of them were clustered around central Wuhan, particularly on the west bank of the Yangtze River, which is exactly the same area as the Wuhan wet market. So they did some statistical analysis on this and confirmed that it was extremely unlikely that you would have seen this pattern of cases clustered around the market if it had originated elsewhere, i.e. a lab. They kind of compared this group of people to a random selection of similar people in terms of demographics from around Wuhan, and they found that a similar selection of people from of those demographics would have been very unlikely to have lived so close to the market. And even those early patients who didn't have like direct links to the market, they didn't work there, they didn't shop there, were still more likely to live close to it. So that's maybe one clue that the market was, you know, a statistical confirmation that the market was involved.
Yeah, so I think that's really interesting. But obviously a high level of transmission focusing on that market doesn't in of itself imply that the entire outbreak started there, right? So if you see the snapshots from later on in the pandemic, there might have been similar patterns that found in super spreader events in like center of cities in Italy or Seattle, for example. How did they determine that this was the origin of the pandemic and not just a super spreader event for a virus that originated elsewhere?
Yeah, so obviously you're right, and you would have seen the same thing if there was a single introduction of a virus into a big city. You would have seen a spread around the original introduction point, but that doesn't necessarily imply that COVID was born there, as it were. So to strengthen their case beyond the WHO data, they researchers also looked at the Chinese microblogging service Weibo, which is like Chinese Twitter, I guess, is the closest analogy. So they looked at people who were posting posting requests for assistance on Weibo in January and February 2020. And what they found with that was that they weren't clustered around the market, but more to the west and more densely populated areas of the city and in areas with more older people. So what this shows is that by January and February, the pandemic had shifted from being centered on the market to being kind of more broadly spread in line with the demographic setup of Wuhan as a whole. It started to mirror the population density of the city. The other thing they looked at is historical kind of location-based check-ins on Weibo, which show that basically, the Huanan market was not a place where a lot of people spent a lot of time. Mm-hmm. People have this vision of it as being this like cramped, super spreader kind of environment. And, you know, if you think of it like that, then it kind of makes sense that, okay, well, if the virus was introduced from elsewhere into the market, then it could have spread there.
Yeah.
But actually, it wasn't the kind of market that you would necessarily go to very often. There were very, very few check-ins there on these social media apps. It was like quite a relatively sparsely populated market. It wasn't that busy. And if you think about it, you know, how many people are buying live animals on a day-to-day basis? Not many. It's a very select small group of people. It wasn't like a supermarket. So it was unlikely to be the location of a super spreader event unless the virus actually originated from there.
Right. So let's delve a little bit closer into this. So that work gave them the location of where COVID had emerged in this market. But how did they trace it back to its source? How could they do that?
Right. So they've pegged the virus to the market using these statistical techniques. So they need to kind of figure out how it got to the market in the first place. So to do that, they turned to swab samples. So the Chinese scientists, when COVID first broke out, collected swab samples from all around the market. So this was in January 2020, just before the market got shut down. And the swabs that they did, they kind of swabbed various surfaces and then sent them off for analysis. And they found a cluster of positives for COVID in the southwestern corner of the market. So there was swabs on a glove that was found on one of the stalls. There were swabs that tested positive on a grate from under one of the cages in the market. And five of the positive samples came from a single stall. And this stall was known to be selling live animals in late 2019. And that also tallied with a photograph that had been taken by one of the researchers, a guy whose surname was Holmes, amazingly given our detective kind of theme we've got going on. A photograph taken by this guy, Eddie Holmes, who had visited the same stall back in 2014. And when he'd visited in 2014, he'd seen cages of raccoon dogs and bears were kind of stacked on top of each other. And he'd taken a photo because he thought, this is exactly the kind of place where pandemics start. And lo and behold, 5 years later, 6 years later, this is exactly where some of the swabs that tested positive for COVID came from.
All right, so it feels like the lab theory is debunked. other theories that have emerged in the past was that someone was bitten by an animal at some point, and that's how it went crossed over from you know, animal to human. So they looked at that too, though. What did they find?
Yeah, so the timing is interesting, right? The sort of, because on its own, this doesn't necessarily debunk the lab theory, pinning it to the market and the gloves and stuff, because you could still say, okay, well, maybe it was introduced in that southwestern corner and the photo is just a coincidence. But the other way they've looked into it is using COVID's molecular clock. So as you probably know by now, viruses mutate slowly over time. And by tracking these mutations, you can get this kind of sense of how a virus is changing, and you can build a picture up of when it changed and where it was when it changed and things like that. And it had been kind of assumed that a virus jumping from animals into humans was a bit of bad luck. You know, it was the kind of thing where it happens kind of by accident, and then, you know, it was amplified by bad decision making because they didn't shut it down quickly enough. But actually, what the research on the genetic phylogeny of COVID, which is what they call it, was that actually, it's thought that COVID was introduced not just once, but several times. So there was two different lineages called Lineage A and Lineage B that were introduced into the market around the same time. And they basically figured out that this pattern of mutations that they saw was better explained by multiple introductions rather than one introduction. So basically what they think is that there are actually up to a dozen different crossover events, because in order for a disease like COVID to kind of take, to start an epidemic, it needs to infect someone who's going to spread it widely, and not everyone spreads it widely. So in order to have two introductions that persist, in order to have both Lineage A and Lineage B versions of COVID spreading in the market in December 2019, you needed to have like at least eight different introductions from animals to humans at that time, which does rule out the lab leak theory.
Again, I'm going to be playing Watson here because I do know the answer. but why does it matter that there were several sort of occasions when that crossover happened? If one, you know, wasn't potentially enough to get that infection rate up, why does it matter that there were so many of them?
So it's significant for two reasons. So if you're a proponent of the lab leak theory, your theory is that a person either maliciously or deliberately infected someone in the market.
Yeah.
So someone who worked at the lab caught the disease at the lab because, you know, a test tube valve smashes and they inhale COVID, and then they go to the market to do their shopping and they infect a load of people, and that's how it kind of starts. Right. But if there are eight multiple introductions, that makes that theory less plausible, right? It damages the lab leak hypothesis. It's kind of so concordant with like what we've seen with other epidemics, this multiple introduction idea, that it makes the lab leak theory really, really implausible. And the other reason it's important is that it sort of, there's been a narrative throughout the pandemic of Chinese scientists or Chinese government making matters worse, which is kind of fueled by political mistrust and tensions. And that's true in some cases, like Chinese authorities obviously made mistakes and they obstructed access to information. But it's also important because it shows that the data collected by Chinese scientists is the only way that we've been able to analyze COVID in such detail at all. So one thing that I was really struck by is that, you know, when we were dealing with Ebola and when we were dealing with Zika, it took, you know, a year and a half for them to figure out that a Zika epidemic was even happening. It took several months for them to realize that the 2014 Ebola outbreak was happening, whereas it took just a matter of weeks for doctors to figure out that there was an epidemic going on. We've got an unprecedented view of the early picture of the pandemic, and that's only because of the data that was collected at the time.
And so what does this mean now?
So if you put it all together, it means that we have environmental sampling data that can place the spillover of COVID from animals to humans precisely in the southwest corner of the Huanan market to a specific kind of stall. Mm-hmm. And we have genetic testing of virus samples that shows us kind of almost an exact date around November the 18th, 2019 for the introduction of Lineage B with Lineage A a week later. So that kind of gets us very close, but after that, the trail runs cold. So we know which animals were being sold in the market in late 2019. We know which ones were susceptible to coronaviruses. But what researchers don't have is a smoking gun. They don't have samples of the virus from animals that had the virus before it jumped over to humans. And the problem is that's kind of unlikely to be possible at this point, right? There are theories about how infected animals may have reached the market. So the best theory for like how COVID happened basically goes something like this. So Wuhan's in Hubei province in China, and to the west of that region, there are caves where horseshoe bats live. Horseshoe bats are kind of the known reservoir animal for coronaviruses. And those caves are close to farms where millions of raccoon dogs and civets live. So the most likely course of event is something like a bat infected with a novel coronavirus flies over a farm full of raccoon dogs or civets where they're being reared for meat. It poops on one of the animals and viral particles infect one of the animals, and there's a kind of unseen wave of infections among the animals on this farm. Maybe the virus crosses over and infects some farm workers at the farm, but because it's a very low density area, it kind of fizzles out before anyone really notices. There's not enough population density to sustain an epidemic. But all the while, these animals are still being shipped out for export. They're being shipped to places like Wuhan for the, you know, so the wine and seafood market, so where they're being sold at these stores in the southwest corner. So that's where you have this really high density of humans. You have this high density of animals with this novel coronavirus. The virus crosses over maybe 8 times. The majority of those infections fizzle out without spreading to anyone else. But 2 of those infections take hold and start to spread. One becomes lineage A, one becomes lineage B. A few weeks after that, dozens of people in the area start to come down with a mysterious viral pneumonia.
So, I know I'm getting a little bit off piste here, but I'm going to ask you about an animal we haven't mentioned yet, the pangolin.
Yeah.
Anything there?
Yeah, the pangolin gets a bad rep. The pangolin gets a bad rep. It's on the list of animals.
Feels
that,
like a smear.
Yeah,
it
has
campaign.
Been. The pangolin has had the curious case of the missing pangolin. You could call our little investigation. Yeah, the pangolin is on the list of animals that were being sold at Wuhan Market at the time, but is not thought to be a likely candidate anymore. The more likely candidate is thought to be raccoon dogs or civets now.
Innocent. Good. So let's go back to this investigation. Bearing in mind that they can't find any samples from animals, does this kind of mean that's the end? Can they find any definitive proof now? Is there any chance that they can move this forward?
Yeah, so the animals, as you said, the animals that carried the coronavirus originally are probably long dead, right? You know, shipped off and sold for meat or killed in one of the mass culls that took place in early 2020. So after COVID broke out, the Chinese authorities kind of clamped down on the live animal trade and killed a lot of the animals at the farms. But there are still leads that could be followed, so they could figure out who was selling stuff in the southwest corner of the market at the time, trace the supply chains, find out which farms supplied them. They can pore over the paperwork from the culls to find out where the animals from that farm were buried. They could, if they can find out where they were buried, they could dig them up and sequence their DNA to look for remnants of a coronavirus that looks almost identical to those early human cases of SARS-CoV-2. That's going to be like a really long process. It's going to really need really like patient work and international cooperation in a frankly quite a difficult political environment. But it could also be, you know, one of the few good ways we have of figuring out how this pandemic happened and figuring out how to stop the next one.
I really love this story, and I think it has plenty of meaty more things in it. So if you want to, you can read more in the show notes, and on wire.com.
For our second story this week, we are talking about Rickrolls, which, if you don't know what they are, it's a kind of online prank that's been running for a little while where you basically fool someone into clicking on the YouTube video for Never Gonna Give You Up by Rick Astley. And we're looking at one Rickroll in particular, Matt Burgess.
So at 10:55 a.m. on April the 30th last year, 2021, all of the TV screens and classroom projectors at 6 schools across Cook County in Illinois started controlling themselves. Screens that were turned off, powered on. Projectors that were already on automatically switched to the HDMI input, and a message appeared on the screen: please stand by for an important announcement. Under that message, there was a 5-minute timer counting down to zero, and one teacher in a classroom tried to turn off a projector using the infrared remote, but when they did, it was completely disabled and useless. They told students in their classroom they overtook our projector, and this group speculated that it could be a message, the important message that was coming up from the president, or failing that, they joked it could be Big Brother. This pretty much exact same scene was repeating itself across dozens of classrooms in Illinois School District 214, which is home to around sort of 12,000 students. In classrooms and hallways, more than 500 screens displayed this countdown. The system basically had been hijacked. When the countdown hit zero, you might guess from Amit's introduction there, Rick Astley appeared on the screen and started singing Never Gonna Give You Up. And this, yeah, was happening across multiple schools, potentially seen by thousands of students at once. In one of these classrooms was a student called Min Dong, who is a senior on the verge of graduating. He and 3 other friends were behind this Astley appearance, and they did it essentially as a high school prank for graduating. As high school pranks go, it was pretty elaborate. They spent months working on the sort of setup to broadcast the stream to thousands of students at once, and they dubbed it between themselves the Big Rick. And really, it wasn't a simple process. During the process, the group broke into the school's IT systems, repurposed software used to monitor students' computers, discovered a new vulnerability in the software and reported it to the creators, wrote their own scripts, secretly tested the system at night, and managed to avoid detection by the school's IT admins throughout.
I bet this guy's got a cool hacker nickname.
He does. Well, it's reasonable. It's a White Hood Hacker.
Ooh.
Which is a play on the
White Hood.
It's a play on the term of like when you get groups of hackers, they're either white hat or black hat, and black hat ones are ones that do like malicious hacking, criminal stuff. White hat hacking is like security research, and then White Hood Hacker is a play on it's meant to be a play on sort of like teenagers in hoodies being hackers.
Oh, okay, because it sounds like a KKK reference.
Yeah, definitely not that. It was more of a play on words and a joke. Okay.
Yeah, I would advise him, if he's listening, to tweak his nickname before he uses it again. So this all sounds kind of harmless, but that's actually quite illegal, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So the students had spent months tampering with these systems, accessing stuff that they shouldn't have done. And the state of Illinois has a computer crime prevention law. And this essentially makes the intentional hacking of a computer's a criminal offense. I think it's within the law, it's called something like computer tampering. And essentially that accessing a computer, a program or data without permission from its owner is illegal.
So how did they do it? To take over 500 screens across different schools and different districts, presumably it was quite a sophisticated thing that these four guys did.
Yeah, it was in some ways, but also other parts of it were quite basic. So Donk started hacking his school during his freshman year. This was about when he would be 14. And at the time, he said he didn't really understand the basic ethics or responsible disclosure that's involved with sort of like security research. And he was at this time when he was 14, he was able to access two main systems, one something called LAN school, and then also the IPTV system, which controls the screens. So the first element of this, LAN school, is a piece of software that teachers and students have. It's on student laptops. Teachers can use it to see the screen of every student. They can record the software can record keystrokes. It's essentially a piece of, in many ways, a piece of spyware, but it's designed for educational purposes and used to really try and protect students in some ways, but also to give teachers a view on what they're doing. So these four hackers essentially used LAN school to cover their tracks and make it look like their hacking was happening at another part of it, in another school, essentially. So they logged into it in one place but made it look like they were logging into it from somewhere else. And then once they got hold of this, they were able to get into the IPTV system, which is the system that controls the screens. And this system is made up of three different parts, which has receivers that directly control or directly connect to projectors and displays, encoders that broadcast video, and servers that allow products to be managed centrally by administrators. They were originally going to use these servers that to broadcast Rick Astley's video across all of the screens, but essentially they decided that might be a bit too complex and get them caught. So if they were sending out 500 different broadcasts of the signal of the stream to all of the projectors, that's going to be a lot of network traffic that appears at once, and admins would be able to see that and decide that actually there's something dodgy going on here, might be able to shut it down or something along those lines. So they decided to do it a slightly different way, and instead they created a script which acts as a payload which could be uploaded to each receiver ahead of the rickroll. So over the course of a month, they sent out this script to all of the individual projectors, doing it in sort of a few different batches to avoid being detected, and essentially using that and a few other systems and elements that is probably too detailed to go into here, they were able to basically set this up to start streaming at the time of their attack. They actually had to like launch it in the classroom at the time when they were doing it, just making sure that everything was operating okay. And they also sort of like built out a system so that teachers couldn't turn it off. So within the code of this IPTV system, there was an option to disable the infrared remotes, which people would used to change the different options on the projector, but they also had a loop in there that essentially made sure the projector was turned on every 10 seconds. So if a teacher tried to turn it off, it would come back on, and pretty much they created a way that the only way that teachers could have stopped this rickroll from happening would be to pull out the power cable on the projector.
Things have come a long way since I was at school, because I remember like when I was at school, you could buy these like watches with infrared remotes in, and then if you were like watching TV in the lesson, you could like mess around with the volume and stuff like that using these infrared watches. So things have progressed since then somewhat. And it wasn't just, one of the reasons I really love the story is because it's like very like 80s high school movie, don't you think? And particularly this next bit. So they also managed to get into the kind of PA system, which is a feature of American schools.
Yeah, so they were like before and the build-up to the hack and putting it on the IPTV systems, they were like, wouldn't it be cool if we could also sort of broadcast Never Gonna Give You Up out of the speakers that are in the hallways and also in the classrooms? They couldn't actually do it at the same time as the video played, because the TV screens that were used actually used that system anyway, but they wanted to try and control the announcement system that that they were doing it. And while they, like 3 days before they were due to launch the attack, while they were scanning the district network for a second time, they found a system called EPIC, which is the Education Paging and Intercom Communication System. And like this IPTV system, the group tried to access EPIC using default usernames and passwords. However, while they hadn't been reset on the TV system, they had been reset on the speaker system, and the school had reset the default password, but the teenage hackers were able to look at the manuals online for this system, and they found that one of the sort of like setup manuals had its own default password on there. So they, like, it had been changed. The school had changed the default password to one that was in the instructions to set it up,
right.
And they typed that in, and essentially that worked, which gave them ultimately access to be able to control the bells and systems. So they changed one of the school bells at the end of the day, I think it was around 2:25, 3 o'clock, to play Rick Astley again, and they started blaring it out at the end of the day, as well as their TV screen stuff earlier in the day too.
So it's kind of a combination of quite high tech, quite complicated stuff, and quite low tech. Like a lot of cybersecurity, I guess, it kind of is partly human error, partly sophisticated loopholes and stuff like that.
Yeah, the students needed some technical knowledge to be able to get into the systems and move around, but some of the factor that the school hadn't changed default passwords, and there were some passwords that were literally password, which in like the cybersecurity 101 is, you don't have a password as password, even if it's on something as innocuous as a system that seemingly innocuous that controls all the projectors and screens in a school.
So what I mean, the school must have been quite embarrassed by this, or were they okay with it?
So it seems like from me speaking to them, and also sort of the students' reaction, and sort of some teachers' social media posts at the time as well, that they were relatively cool about it. So there were a bunch of other high school pranks that were happening that day, so it wasn't a completely isolated event. And when I asked the school about it, they said that they sort of confirmed that all of this happened, and while they said that they don't condone hacking, they said that the incident highlights the importance of extensive cybersecurity learning opportunities that the school has. And also they say that they see it as a penetration test, which is, in like the cybersecurity world, penetration tests are researchers trying to purposely break into devices to see if there are any flaws or stuff like that. So the school was pretty much said, we accept that there were these errors and things like that. It was good that the students pointed them out to us.
Yeah, and the students themselves were quite clever about how they sort of managed this, right? Because they treated it like a penetration test, as you're saying. They treated it like they were testing the school's system, and they even wrote a report afterwards.
Yeah, so Dong, who was their sort of like lead hacker coordinator behind this, is now studying cybersecurity at university, and he was doing some other sort of like cybersecurity qualification stuff while he was basically conducting the Big Rick, and they wrote a 26-page report, which was sent to the school admin straight after the incident, that detailed what they had done and provided security suggestions. And the report, which they shared a redacted version with us, basically said that the group had set out a list of guidelines that they could, or that sort of guided the Rick role, and these basically said that they shouldn't do anything that would harm the safety of others, would look to keep any disruption to learning to a minimum. They did it at the end of a lesson on a Friday before exam started, so it wasn't a time when there was a lot of people in class necessarily, and they also had like various other guidelines that said that they would not access private information that they could have done through having teacher level access to some of the systems, and would essentially reset everything to how it was beforehand. So they were quite actually responsible and organized about this, and the sort of the report that they wrote looks pretty professional too, and the school sort of emailed them back after a couple of weeks of this happening, and then they were like, we're not going to take any disciplinary action because we think that you've done this in a good way, and we understand it. Basically the school used some common sense.
So what's the lesson here? Why are we talking about this? Is there a kind of bigger point here about school security, about cybersecurity more general, that we can learn from this story?
I mean, mostly because it's quite fun as a graduation prank. So the hacking team behind it said they didn't launch it as a way to sort of like show that there were vulnerabilities in the school system. And it was pretty much designed to be a graduation prank, but one that they decided to handle responsibly afterwards, because they knew if the school didn't take it right, or the school district didn't take it right, then there could be sort of some sort of legal consequences or that down the line. But there is also I always like to bring a little bit of tedium to the podcast, but there is also a little bit of a more serious point to it as well, that like in the last few years we have seen a lot of schools being sort of subject to cyber attacks and all of those kind of things. In this incident, the access that the students managed to get. They could have actually accessed private information, personal information. They could have done stuff that would be even more illegal, would have been potentially damaging, showing the sort of like, if who was behind this attack was malicious, then they could have actually caused a lot further impact. So we have seen that on a more broader sense, schools have been hit by ransomware attacks. There have been like national cybersecurity agencies, like the one in the UK has put out sort of guidance and warnings to schools that they need to take some of this stuff more seriously. And also, I think that when you're looking at this, there was a school in the US as well that last year got shut down because of the impact of COVID-19 and a ransomware attack combined. So it is a bit of a serious issue that is, that people in these environments should look at. But really, I think it was just a fun prank that they tried to play.
It's a really interesting story. Do check it out on wired.com and do let us know about your legal high-tech pranks, because I think those will be quite fun to hear about. That's about all you've got time for. But thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.